Culture Ninja. I'm Nathan, and joined with Nathan. How you doing, Nathan?
I'm doing very, very well. However, and this is pulling the curtain back, it's very, very early right now when we're recording this.
Yeah, and the music you just heard is a product of it being very, very early.
Yes, you may have never heard Close Encounters of the Third Kind quite that way before.
Yeah, but, you know, it's always good to throw something new into the mix. So we have special guests today. I'm going to let you go ahead and introduce her.
Just, yeah, in case we didn't have enough Bartle Balls on this podcast already. So we have two Nathans, and now we also have two Bartle Balls. My sister Rachel is joining us today.
Hi, guys.
Rachel, you want to sort of introduce yourself more than that?
I'm Rachel Bartle Ball, youngest sibling to Nathan. And I don't know what you're looking for.
That'll do.
All right, that works.
So I'm really excited about this, probably most excited in terms of the podcast we've done so far, because we're really going to start getting into looking at a director and his films, which we really haven't done before.
Yeah.
Not so far. I mean, we really just got started. We were talking the other day how I think this will mark podcast number 12, I think. Mm-hmm. So we've got quite a few under our belt considering we've only been going for about a month and a half. So what we wanted to do was sort of something a little bit special. This will actually, you're hearing now the very first episode of what's going to be a 3 or 4 part episode of the films of Steven Spielberg, and specifically not just the films of Steven Spielberg, because he's got quite a few. Like, you're talking about how Stephen King has a lot of books. Well, Steven Spielberg has a lot of movies. If you're looking at just the stuff he directed, if you go into IMDb and don't limit it to the stuff he's directed, you're lost forever, because he's apparently produced every major movie that was released in the past 30 years. But what we wanted to do is coming up at the end of, well, really, I guess the beginning of July, I think, the BFG, his version of the Roald Dahl story about the little girl and the giant, comes out to theaters. Mm-hmm. And Spielberg is still one of those directors. I mean, he can be up and down with me sometimes in terms of what I think of his movies. But for whatever reason, I very rarely get excited when a movie comes out these days. And for whatever reason, when one of his new movies comes out, I still feel like it's still kind of an event. You still want to go and see what he has to offer. I think he's one of the few filmmakers that from that period of the 70s when he started, Scorsese would probably be the other one, that is still making pretty consistently strong work. Maybe not as strong as when he was first around. I think that's, you could argue that pretty well. But he's still making movies that are kind of worth seeing. We're not talking kind of like George Lucas or even Francis Ford Coppola, who is more interested in making wine than movies these days. You know, but a lot of those guys from the 70s, they have very strong filmographies that will never be challenged in that regard, but they're not necessarily still producing, not at the rate that somebody like Spielberg is. But what we wanted to do is look at the fantastical films, those movies of his that Rachel and I were talking about this, and Nathan, you and I were talking about this. They almost define our childhoods, I think, in terms of what we think about movies and or particularly blockbuster movies.
Yeah.
So we're going to look at the ones that have fantastical elements. I'm also including movies like his earlier movie Duel and Jaws, which while aren't supernatural, I think they fall within sort of the horror genre, and they have elements that are outside the scope of normative. Yeah. So I think those are going to fall in. Everything else will be fantasy stuff. We'll kind of mention as we go along where his other stuff falls, but I'm not going to discuss it really in any way. So. Right. Before we get started, though, what are you guys' general thoughts about Spielberg, Nathan?
Yeah, I mean, he, like you said, Nathan, he's one of those guys who just, as a director, when I think back to, you know, the big guys, you know, thinking, like you said, you've got Lucas, Spielberg, Coppola, Scorsese, those guys of like that 70s, 80s era that are just really out there. They were on the forefront of doing some really cool stuff with special effects, with storytelling, with just giving both children and adults this sense of awe and wonder. And Spielberg, I think, has just really taken that and continued with it. You know, I know we're not really going to talk about this, but I remember a few years ago when War Horse came out, just, you know, as a 30-year-old going to see that and just my, jaw-dropping and just being in awe at the end of that movie, because it's like, wow, this, he's still got it. You know, this is classic Spielberg. Really enjoyed the movie, enjoyed the storytelling. And he did a good job of at making this horse that doesn't talk. It's not like, you know, a fantastical children's movie, but this horse that doesn't talk, the star of the movie, and following this horse in his adventure.
Yeah, that's a good point. We won't talk much about War Horse, but the thing about War Horse, it was based off a play that was based off a children's book. But the thing about the play that was memorable or notable was that it was the way they created the horse, this big sort of moving mechanical horse that was on stage. So that thing was so impressive that sort of overwhelmed everything else. And now Spielberg's got to go make the movie version of this with just a real regular old horse. So he had to do a few different things. And I, what I liked about that movie, it was super melodramatic in a lot of ways, but it was melodramatic in a way that harkened back to a much older kind of movie making. Like, he was really making a throwback movie that if you had released it in like 1955 alongside National Velvet or something, it was a little bit more violent than that, but it would have fit perfectly in. And he did it in a way that transported you, so you weren't sitting there rolling your eyes the whole time. I wasn't anyway.
Yeah. Rachel?
I think for me, a couple podcasts back for you guys, you were talking about the Ninja Turtles. I think it was that one. You were talking about that nostalgia. And for me, I think, especially if we've been talking about it this week, a lot of my cinematic nostalgia is sort of based around Steven Spielberg. I didn't even realize how much, like, Arachnophobia terrified me as a kid. And, running around the house, makeshift whips with Indiana Jones and the things I did. I know he's just a producer on, but American Tail, Land Before Time. I loved Batteries Not Included. And when I'm seeing movies come out now, I don't know if it's just because I'm older or if it is just a very different style of movie making, I don't get that same thrill and excitement and awe, you know, that I got from a lot when I went back and looked at a lot of the movies I really remember and loved as a kid were Spielberg. He was associated with him in some way. And recently when I saw the preview for BFG, that nostalgia sensation kind of came back to me. It was like, oh, all that awe and the wonder and the kind of magical qualities, I guess, to it. So,
yeah, I agree.
And that's what I think of when I think of Spielberg, at least.
And I think that's one of the other things that'll be interesting to look at. So what we're going to do through the course of this podcast series is start with the beginning of his career, looking at the movies he started making, again, within the fantastical vein, and move forward. But as we're doing that, we're not going to fully review the movies, but we're going to look at them and pick out those fantastical elements, talk about what is it exactly that seems to resonate. Because, I mean, you've got a guy now who's worth about $3 billion banking off of really that ability to capture these things we're calling awe and wonder and basically packaging them and making them his brand, more or less. Yeah. And it's interesting because directors, when you look at the whole scope of things, in particular, I think you can say this about Spielberg. Spielberg has found a way for people to associate a specific sort of thing with him, even though it's the result of a lot of different really talented people coming to work. What I mean by that is if you see like the cinematography of all the people he's worked with over the years, and like there are some specific ones that if you see their cinematography, it is theirs, but it's been so closely tied to Spielberg movies that we think of some of those, and Spielberg has such a handle on the production of every one of his movies that it all seems tied together. And so we think of that as a Spielberg trademark, not necessarily a trademark. John Williams' music John Williams, but it is also very much Spielberg, you know, in a sense. So we're going to look at it from that perspective. And then also I've got a little bit of stuff I've pulled in regarding Spielberg and his background that we can talk about, maybe where this comes from for him, what he was pulling when he did it. So, yeah, I'm excited because I have that same kind of feeling where when I go back and see these things, and it's clear that the modern movies know and understand where that sense of nostalgia comes from. J.J. Abrams is basically he wouldn't even have a career if it really wasn't for Spielberg and Lucas. And that could be a bit of a criticism because I don't think he's really come into his own. He's only found a way to sort of harbor the nostalgia he had for those old movies. Like Super 8 was just like one giant homage, obviously, to Spielberg. And unapologetically it was. It didn't pretend to be anything else. But I think it'll be interesting to go back and look at those movies with that veneer of the Spielberg awe lifted from it, and kind of go through and just check it out, because it's an impressive resume. It's also an impressive slate of movies. But I think that within those movies, more than maybe other directors we could choose, probably is going to pinpoint some of the things we as a culture are really trying to get out of entertainment these days.
Sure. So let's go ahead and start right off. I mean, we have Duel and Something Evil as, you know, kind of his earliest pieces of work that we're going to sit here and talk about. Nathan, why don't you go ahead and start us off with those?
Yeah, so to put this in just a little bit of context, at the time that Spielberg is making these films, and these are two movies that are actually TV movies. So he was going to college. He ended up dropping out of college. He got involved with studio, and he was involved with ABC working on television. The first thing I think he really directed was an episode of Rod Serling's Night Gallery, which was not exactly a spinoff of The Twilight Zone, but it was another Rod Serling anthology series. It was probably closer in a lot of ways to Tales from the Crypt than it was The Twilight Zone.
Right.
So it had a lot of the same writers, though. One of the writers on both The Twilight Zone and Night Gallery was a guy named Richard Matheson. And I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with him, but Matheson is sort of a foundational guy in the sci-fi fantasy universe that most people aren't even aware of. Like, they don't know his name, but they know his work, whether they're aware or not. He wrote books like What Dreams May Come, The Incredible Shrinking Man, I Am Legend was probably one of the more popular Matheson books. He did Somewhere in Time, The Legend of Hell House, a lot of stuff that was really popular. He also wrote a lot of classic Twilight Zone episodes, like The Eye of the Beholder, you know, where the girl has the wrappings on her face, and you know, what it turns out to be is that she's beautiful, but everybody else is, you know, hideous big people or something. Yeah, I just spoiled The Twilight Zone. Sorry, guys. but classic Twilight Zone episodes. He did the classic Star Trek episode that introduced us to evil William Shatner, the evil Kirk. So one of the reasons we have so much hammy overacting may be chalked up to Matheson. So Matheson had been on both of those shows. Again, he was a writer. He was writing short stories and getting them published. And it's weird now because I don't think this is much of a thing people think about. But back in the 70s, like, mainstream authors like King and other people were getting their work published in like Playboy, like short stories. And so at one point, Spielberg, his secretary, comes to him and says, "Oh, here's this story by Richard Matheson that you should really read." And he's like, "Oh, where'd this come from?" She's like, "It's in Playboy." He's like, Why did you have Playboy? She goes, "Really, the articles are very good." So he was like, "Okay." And he read the story and really liked it. And he was able to work out a deal. He had only directed this a couple episodes of stuff. The guy who he met to discuss it said, "You know, well, what do you have?" And basically the demo really gave him was an episode of Columbo he had just directed. Nice. So before that, he really hadn't done anything. He had done a, in terms of feature length, he had just done an episode of a TV series from the early 70s that was part of something that was kind of an anthology. He did LA 2017, which was interestingly an episode where all the characters fell asleep and woke up in the future. So it was his first attempt at telling a kind of sci-fi story. That was all he had done. So when he does Duel, it's based off this Matheson short story. Matheson writes it because he was one day coming home from like a golf match with one of his friends, and this trucker started tailgating him. And I guess it just triggered something. It must have gotten intense enough that it was sort of a scary, you know, road rage is kind of all the thing these days. But right. Back in the 70s, maybe not so much. So it really bothered him. He wrote a story about it. The story is essentially this two-hander cat and mouse game on an open highway out in the American Midwest, really, between a guy driving cross-country and this giant truck, which is described in the story as like a big gas-guzzling tanker truck.
Yeah, a little ramshackled.
Yeah, it rolls up and just starts terrorizing him, and it continues. You know, he encounters it once, he goes away, he can kind of push it out of his mind, he encounters it again and again. And then when Spielberg makes this, it is initially an ABC movie. So they make the movie, it does quite well, it's very popular, it releases like 1971. It's popular enough at the time that when they do this, they actually release it like the next year in a theatrical format. So they send him back and film chunks of it. And Rachel, I know you just watched it recently on like DVD.
Yeah.
The version you see on DVD is the 90-minute film that was actually released in theaters. So Spielberg was, in the beginning, they only gave him 10 days to film the whole thing to get it to the... I mean, so this is one of the things we'll notice about Spielberg as we go along, that he can get production. He makes a lot of movies, but he makes a lot of movies that are very high technical productions. Yeah. So Duel comes out, and Duel is, when it's released, I think the way we would characterize it is it's really a kind of a horror movie. It stars mm-hmm. Dennis Weaver. Spielberg wanted Weaver because he was in a movie that Spielberg had seen, Touch of Evil, where he played this kind of crazed, paranoid motel owner. And he saw in the motel owner the craziness. He wanted the character starts out very straight-laced in Duel. Where he arrives by the end of the story after being terrorized by this truck for 2 hours is sort of where Spielberg saw Weaver come in. He said, I want him to be the guy from Touch of Evil by the end of this movie.
Right.
And so Duel comes out. It's on TV. And it comes out in a time when TV movies are very, very popular. And they were in all sorts of different genres. But there were a lot of horror, thriller kind of things coming out. So, Rachel, you saw it. What did you think about it?
I liked it. I'll confess that in the 80s, I was a fan of the killer car movies. What was it? Christine. And I forget the other one. The Black Car. What was it?
Wheels of Terror.
Oh, I love that movie. I did. But Duel is a little bit different. The menacing is like it's a little bit creepier. You actually see like at one point the truck driver like sticks his hand out. So coming from liking the horror car movies, I was like, is it an evil car? Is it an evil driver? I don't know. But you actually see you don't see the driver, but you see his arm come out and wave him around like ominously.
Which I think is all you ever see of the driver in the entire
it is.
Film.
But it does get, it's an older film, so it doesn't have the same effect as like what we would call horror movies now. But it's definitely creepy. And there was like there's very little dialogue. I mean, there's maybe 5 sentences to the whole movie, and I'm not even strongly exaggerating there. There's very little dialogue. It's more him talking to himself or his inner monologue, thinking, and it's really just you reacting to what you're seeing. And that always creates more tension. And there's a lot of, what is going on here? Is this real? Who is this guy even? And there's very little about the main character. He kind of makes a comment in the beginning of the movie, like he's listening to something on the radio and he's like, I'm not the man of my house. And then at the end, he's kind of transformed into this other guy who is kind of toughened up by this experience a little bit. And I don't know. I mean, that seemed to me like an obvious element of the movie, but it was a little tense at times, a little creepy.
Nathan, have you seen Duel?
I have not, but, I've seen similar movies like this. And so I think, one of the elements in this movie that really works and draws people in is that fear of being on the road and somebody chasing you down. I mean, mm-hmm. you hear that, I mean, Joyride came out not too long ago with, what was it, Paul Walker?
You say not too long ago, but that was 2001, my friend.
Wow. Gosh, that's crazy. Well, wasn't there like Joyride 2, 3, 4, 5, and all that.
I'll check the Walmart bin and get back to you. Yeah. Maybe we have a contest where we give them all away. I could probably get them for about $4.50.
Oh, nice. But you really, when you're touching on that, Rachel, you talked about horror that we don't really see today, but there is something horrific about playing into the fear of, oh man, somebody's chasing, somebody's following you. I mean, you're out there alone and, nobody's around, and that really does play into that. And, mm-hmm. You get that intense feeling and the heart starts pounding. And it's like, one night when you're driving alone and it's like, you hearken back to that movie and it's like, oh crap, And
it was intensified because you're talking about like on the back roads, or the movie is done all in, I don't know, it's Arizona or what, it's like mm-hmm. desert highway. So there's nothing around. At one point he runs into a restaurant with like creepy desert people, like but it's like
there's a whole bunch of crazy desert people just waiting for a movie to come along and involve them.
That's great.
And the truck, of course, is like, it's rusted out, it's dripping stuff, it's like this monster of a truck.
There's some really good, like on the DVD, and also even if you just go to YouTube, there's a lot of really great segments where Spielberg is talking about the making of this movie. It's really cool because it's clearly the Spielberg of now, where he's got, as much money as he wants and has had many, many successes. But it's really cool to see him be so excited talking about this movie and how much fun he had, like, making it, and just that first experience where he was really starting to pull things together that he wanted to do. And in the movie and the book or the story, I think they just kind of refer to it as big gas-guzzling behemoth. But he talked about casting the truck, where he basically went out to the lot and was trying to find one. And the one he got was the Peterbilt 281, which is, like you said, they've made it look very ramshackle. It's very rusted, very dark and imposing. And he said they picked that one because it was the only one that looked like it had a face. Mm. That in the sense that if you were to look at it straight on, there was something vaguely menacing and almost anthropomorphic about it. Not that the truck does anything in the movie like that, but he wanted to give it its own character. And I think that's one of the things that's interesting about this movie. Spielberg has never directed, to my knowledge, he's produced a few, but he's never directed a Western. I think his first, now, a little bit of tidbit, because Rachel, you mentioned Arizona. When he was growing up, his, I think he was originally in Cincinnati, and then his parents moved him to Arizona. Okay. So he grew up in Arizona. His dad got, like, his mom gave his dad, like, a little brownie camera for his birthday, and then his son basically confiscated it and started using it. And he and his dad would do a lot of these things together, and his first, like, kid film that he did was kind of a Western out there in Arizona. But in some ways, I think Duel is probably the closest thing that Spielberg has done, particularly in this fantastical reign of films that involves the elements of kind of a Western. Mm-hmm. Now, Spielberg says he wasn't really thinking about making a Western or a horror movie when he did it. He was just responding to what Matheson wrote and trying to make it as intense as possible. Mm-hmm. But you do have that kind of classic showdown element that you see in Westerns, and this isolation and a sense of the loner and the character who has to basically come up against and fight, like the High Noon scenario, where he's going to put it off as much as he can. He's going to do everything he can to kind of stave off having to face this like force, but eventually he can't do it. You're going to see, if you watch this movie, there is a lot of similarity between this movie and Jaws in the kind of filmmaking that's done. A lot of the close-ups. There's shots of Weaver looking deranged out of the windshield of his car to, or out of the rearview mirror to see this car bearing down on him, that reminds you of later when you see Roy Scheider looking out and seeing Jaws appear on the horizon, you know, and is the way it zooms in, the camera zooms. A lot of the filmmaking is really good. You had said how it seems like, is it really happening? Is it not happening? There's a real visceral sense to this that maybe, I think Matheson's story was a little more psychological. Spielberg, and this is probably one of his strengths, he makes things very real and very visceral. They're always like actually happening, even if they tend to be metaphorical or allegorical. I don't think this one really is very much. But they always tend to also be happening in the here and now. And that's very true of Duel. I think Duel may be one of his stronger movies because it's stripped down to very simple essentials. It's a guy discovering how to hit certain emotional buttons, the same way some of Stephen King's early stuff is. And that's really what he's in tune with.
Yeah.
It's not a super great character piece. It's not a really well-drawn story, except in the very simple beats of this guy versus this truck. And that Peterbilt, the way he shows it on the highway, it's almost like a giant dinosaur, like a monster, which explains why you get Joyride in 2001. And actually, Jeepers Creepers the same year.
Yeah.
Jeepers Creepers had a rusted down kind of truck like that. I don't think those movies are as successful as Duel, because in Duel, and I think this is where we start to get into some of Spielberg's elements as someone who's trying to hit these notes of wonder. Wonder is a key word we use, but what does that really mean? Mm-hmm. In Duel, the truck is like a disruptor. It comes out of nowhere. Dennis Weaver's going around what he thinks is a happy little existence, but he's kind of starting to like check out and just become part of the rat race. So even though the truck is terrifying and scary, it's also kind of the thing that wakes him up to the life that's happening around him. Mm-hmm. So the truck is both like rescuer and destructor. If he kills him, that's really too bad.
Yeah.
But if he survives, like at the very end when he's just like, when he basically defeats the car, the truck, and he's so happy and ecstatic. At that point,
you're not even sure because he's come back so many times. You're like, keeps reassuring himself it's over now. And you're like, no, it's not over. It's coming around the corner. Yeah.
Right. We don't know what happened. It may run him down 5 minutes after the screen went to black, but we don't know that.
I was waiting for it.
Yeah.
Now, Something Evil, this one, you know, I'm going to go ahead and just throw it out there. I know absolutely nothing about, so I'm going to stay mostly silent on this and let you hit this one, Nathan.
You are not alone in that, Nathan. Something Evil was Spielberg's second TV movie, and it's a movie that not many people know of. It's weird because you can find copies of Duel most places. Most people are aware, even if they haven't seen it, of where Duel falls in his filmography. They also are aware of it in a kind of pop culture sense, like a lot of shows and cartoons and stuff have riffed on it. But Something Evil, you can find the entire movie on YouTube, but it is not a movie that I ever hear talked about. I never hear Spielberg talk about it. I don't think they've released it on DVD in any way. That may have to do that Duel ultimately did get its own theatrical release and Something Evil didn't. Something Evil is also, I mean, it is not a great movie. It is kind of an interesting movie, I think, in terms of when you look at it in response to the rest of Spielberg's career. So Something Evil comes out and it's in another batch of TV movies. Possession movies and haunted house movies are a big thing at that point. They're a big thing again now. We just had The Conjuring 2 come out. And there's a lot of similarity, actually, between what happens in Something Evil and what happens in The Conjuring. It's no surprise, too. You can see that James Wan is really sort of pulling from things he saw, like Poltergeist and things of that nature. What's interesting, I think, is when we get to Poltergeist, if you were to look at Spielberg's actual IMDb page, is not listed as a movie he directed. Mm. But there's been a lot of talk, really legitimate talk, about whether Spielberg should be the rightful director of that movie. We'll get to that when we get to Poltergeist. Mm-hmm. What makes Something Evil, I think, valuable, though, in that part of the discussion, is you can see a lot of the groundwork that ends up in Poltergeist, even the way some of the shots are done, even the basic gist of the movie, harkens towards Poltergeist, which does speak strongly to Spielberg having a very authorial influence on that movie. Yeah. So Something Evil stars a couple of people that we've seen in other movies and would see later on. The biggest star that they probably had was Darren McGavin. Darren McGavin is probably most known to everybody as the father from A Christmas Story.
Yeah.
With his leg lamp. Not a finger!
Right.
But and he was also, about a year later, he became Kolchak the Night Stalker on TV. Of course, that was the sort of genesis that ultimately resulted in The X-Files. When Chris Carter was making that show, he harkened back and thought about Night Stalker. In fact, Darren McGavin ended up in several X-Files episodes. But he's here as the father, as the husband. They have a young kid. Sandy Dennis, who I think was in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, has a very kind of neurotic sensibility in those movies, and in this movie too, where she just seems a little bit off. This movie plays that up. The family move out to Bucks County, PA, and they're just out in kind of the boonies there. It's interesting because there's points where you hear McGavin referencing, well, I gotta catch a plane to New Freedom and stuff like that, and I'm like, wait, do they even have an airport? What are you talking about? But in the context of the story, they move out here and they start getting involved in sort of like what would be kind of folk supernatural traditions, things like pentacles and protection ward signs on the side of barns. They move into this house. Something is a little bit off. Sandy Dennis's character starts painting some of these pentacles and stuff on the floor of the house, not in a sinister way, but in hopes that she will be able to protect her children. So she starts getting into this elements of the occult and the supernatural, which at the time in the 70s, people were taking kind of seriously. Like, you know, the Time Life books on like Bigfoot and UFOs and all of this. These were things that people were kind of engaging in. Now, we never think about that for the most part. We just take them as, oh, this is just pure fantasy entertainment. But there was an element where I think some of these producers were hoping that people would think about this. Amityville was big at this time. So the movie is basically another thrall for that. It's very well directed. Spielberg does a lot with very little in terms of creating scenes of suspense. You can start to see some of the elements that end up in a movie like Jaws in this movie. Creepy shots where he has no budget to do supernatural special effects.
Yeah.
So you have to have a creepy scene where later, after they were filming a commercial, they realized that there were red, creepy eyes looking out of a window. Mm-hmm. Or creepy scenes of where we're not sure what's following the woman as it comes out of the barn. You know, it's almost the very first example of that thing that Sam Raimi does in Evil Dead where he attaches a camera to the front of a motorcycle and runs Bruce Campbell down with it. Right. This is the first kind of example of the monster cam. And Something Evil is interesting. I think what is most interesting about it is the themes you start to see develop. The supernatural comes in. It ends up attacking a family. But this movie, unlike Poltergeist, where you know immediately the special effects are there and that the monsters are real, Something Evil plays with the idea that Sandy Dennis may be legitimately troubled or insane. Mm-hmm. We don't see anything that absolutely confirms. We start to wonder, well, she's she's a danger to the children. She could harm the children. She has an old neighbor who comes and gives her the occult books, which sort of spark her mind towards getting involved in this. So at the first part, there's this almost warning about being too involved in the occult. But when we realize that, you know, her child really is sort of possessed by the devil.
Right.
Suddenly the tables...
The concern is real, people. Right.
The tables turn, and now what we see is the mother's, like, love... fastening everything together. You know, Spielberg, The Power of Love is something that maybe was one of those things that was an output of Spielberg's work that maybe we're kind of regretting it was, because The Power of Love has become such a basic and silly thing in movies. It gets trotted out here and there all the time.
Yeah.
There's a line in Something Evil, though, where the neighbor is telling her, he says, if you believe there's a devil, that the devil is in your house, then for you it's true. And he says, some things are more powerful than pentacles. Like love. It's a powerful force. I live only a mile away. A telephone puts us in touch in seconds. Don't hesitate. So it's one of the first times, I think, where Spielberg comes out and says that love can overcome these dark elements. And the movie in the next scene starts to do something very tragic. And you're like, this is going to end badly. Mm-hmm. It's a popular thing in 70s movies, particular horror movies. There's one with Kim Darby called Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, with little monsters mm-hmm. that come out of the grate. You see in this movie something that harkens back to something that we'll talk about a little bit with Spielberg. The father, the husband, is a guy who's always away on work. He's the the workaholic guy who's always away. The mother is the one who's trying to hold the family unit together. And troubling things are happening at home, and the father doesn't know. Many TV movies, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark is one. The husband doesn't get back in time to save the wife, and she succumbs to her neuroses and to the darkness. In this movie, Spielberg allows him to get back, to be a part of the finale, and then the power of love triumphs. But it's all a little bit underplayed. It's an interesting movie, I think, to see in the context of what Spielberg starts to hint at in his other work. You can see the whole thing on YouTube, so it's worth checking out.
Very cool. Now we come to... this is one that, whether you've seen it or not, you know about it. And because of this movie, it has kept many a person out of the ocean for numbers of years. And that, of course, is Jaws. And so what I'd like to do is, because this is just one movie, again, I think pop culture has such roots in this, similar to Star Wars and Indiana Jones. I'd like to spend a little more time talking about this one, focusing on this one. So, Nathan, I'm going to let you go ahead and set it up, and we'll go from there.
I mean, what is there to say about Jaws? Jaws, I think, may be. I didn't think too much about this going through, but what your favorite Spielberg movie is. There are one or two others I'd say compete, but I think Jaws may be my favorite, or very close to it. I will say it may be his most effective in terms of everything working together. It came out, and it came out after Spielberg had done a few other movies. He did get to do his first theatrical movie after this, was called The Sugarland Express, and Goldie Hawn was in it. Mm. But it had got a theatrical release. It wasn't a really super popular movie. It was another movie that dealt with parents that had their children taken away from them and trying to get them back. They were like criminals. So it was, again, that family unit trying to reconnect. Jaws comes along. It's based off the book by Peter Benchley, and who did several kind of shark-related books. Actually, Benchley is known for coming back later in life and saying he kind of regretted Jaws only because of the stigma that it placed on sharks and how everyone sort of viewed them as monstrous killers only. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that's not really what he intended when he did it. So he felt that, you know, not just the book, but the movie all sort of played into that. But Jaws is obviously the movie that really put Spielberg on the map. It's also the movie that most people credit with creating the summer blockbuster in the way we think of it, of a movie where people flock to see a movie. They go to see it, and they come out, and they decide they're going to see it again. Maybe not that same day, but later that week. That's something that now studios almost depend on, this idea that, well, you're going to see this movie a couple of times. I mean, I don't think that was a typical thing.
Yeah.
Movies stayed in theaters a lot longer back then, too. So
yes.
Jaws was probably the main attraction. Jaws is a movie that starts this idea that, wait, a movie can be a big event. You know, Star Wars is still a year or so out.
Yes. Yep.
And when we get Jaws is another movie where there's a disruptor. You have the shark, which comes into the picture. You also have Sheriff Brody's, played by Roy Scheider, like an awesome performance.
We're going to need a bigger boat.
Yes. And it's funny because now I don't know how, I wonder sometimes seeing this movie. So Sheriff Brody comes to the town of Amity. He's there. He has a fear of the water. So they give him a few traits. He ends up working with, I think it's Hooper. Hooper is Richard Dreyfuss' character. Yep. He's the sort of the shark expert. And then they get hooked up with the most awesome character in the movie, which is Robert Shaw's Quint, who's the crusty sea captain. Who, you know, he's always singing the song about the
little song,
the French ladies or whatever. But that when that movie develops and it moves away from a movie where Brody's trying to protect the people of Amity from the threat of the shark, and then the villain is not really even the shark, but it's the town officials who are making the decision to keep the. So you also have this new element of the disbelieving government officials who come in and force Brody, but Brody's the guy who has to stand there when the mother with her dead son comes up and smacks him in the face, and he has to admit and own, you know what, that was me. I allowed people to talk me out of what I'm supposed to be doing here.
Right.
So you've got a lot of that going on. The last third of the movie is almost like an Ernest Hemingway hunting movie in a way. These three guys on a boat bonding as they hunt this thing, and I just think it's a great movie because it is very visceral, but it gives you this sense of wonder and sort of transcendence, even though all we're dealing with really, in a sense, is this big shark.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, one of the things we need to mention too is this is the first time that John Williams comes into the picture.
Yes.
And, you know, we have that wonderful score, which in and of itself almost becomes a character of the movie.
Right from the very beginning, and prior to this, Spielberg had been working with Billy Goldenberg a lot. Like, you know, even then, you could see him setting up where he had these people he preferred to work with.
Yeah.
And Billy Goldenberg did a lot of the scores for his early TV movies. And then this is where he starts his partnership with Williams. I'm glad he started early in his career because I believe Spielberg recommends Williams to Lucas when Lucas is doing Star Wars. So,
and we are eternally grateful for that because at the time, disco was so big that a lot of people, when Lucas first announced he was going to use an orchestra instead of disco music, a lot of people were disappointed. And
how is this going to be a good science fiction movie without disco?
Yes.
Well, it's funny because even that Close Encounters music we played at the beginning, like you can see Lando Calrissian dancing to that out in Despin somewhere with a, what did you say, with a Colt 45. But it's a great score. And you're, like you said, when you hear that score, you think of the shark, you think of the danger, you think of people being attacked in the water.
Well, I was going to say, how many times could you get in a pool, you know, when we were kids without that, someone coming up behind you, probably fill up our other brother or something.
Yeah. And you think about this movie coming out, you know, I mean, we're here in Maryland, Ocean City, you know, 2-3 hours away. I mean, think about that movie coming out in that summer. I mean, you got to imagine how much, you know, business just dropped with people not going into the water during that summer and people just being scared spitless, you know, about sharks and terrified.
It's funny because I think that that's what was intended, but Spielberg and a few other people were talking about it. It was like it almost made them want to do it more.
I was going
to
say it made that tense, like, ooh, you know, gotta.
Which I think is where you get that kind of. The thing that's popular about him is this idea of wonder, of suggesting that there's something more than the mundane that we see. Like, you're right. Oh, I hope I don't see a shark. I hope I see a shark. But I hope I see a shark far away,
not
on my leg.
And also at a time when, like, Reader's Digest was big and you get those shark stories. Yes. Like, this one was real. It really happened. It was just like Jaws. Like,
and then
you
get the picture of the guy's, like, midsection with the little dot. Like,
exactly.
Yeah. Any other thoughts on Jaws and impact in cinema?
Well, one of the things with Jaws, I think that one of the things it starts to do is it creates a sense of a movie being not just a story, but to be a primarily like any something to gain an emotional response, emotional trigger, if you will, like where the primary reason to see the movie is I don't want to be told a great story. I want this movie to do something to me. I want it to hit me in the stomach. We were talking, you start to talk about like video games. We just recently did that podcast with Bob and Chris. And when we were talking about it, it was about like crystallizing emotions.
Yeah.
And you started to see that even in the, like, I keep bringing up Stephen King, but Stephen King and Steven Spielberg are kind of coming up and into prominence at about the same time. Yes. And they're both doing kind of the same thing in different venues, which is crystallizing emotions and making the emotional response the big thing.
Yeah.
They do have good characters. There are strong characters in both Jaws and in books like Carrie and The Shining, mm-hmm. but they almost become secondary when a person remembers it. You think yes. back to Jaws, you don't sit there and think about how realistic Brody seemed, though yeah. I think that he does seem realistic. And his interaction with both Quint and with Hooper are realistic. They're, it's a little exaggerated, but it's realistic. I wonder now, honestly speaking, if the Spielberg of now with his $3 billion and his his bubble where probably people are afraid to tell him, you know, exactly the way things are, if he would have been able to make this movie now, mm-hmm. you know, because he does seem to be keyed into the working class hero, if you will, in a way that maybe he wouldn't be able to do now. Yeah. At the time of Jaws, he captures those guys. They seem like real salt of the earth sort of people. Mm-hmm. And if you get to the wonder thing, I think the coolest thing about Jaws, a big thing is, of course, that the shark, the animatronic shark that they yes. named Bruce, didn't really work.
Yeah.
And it was malfunctioning, and Spielberg was like, what do we do? And in nowadays, that would scuttle a movie. But,
yeah.
of course, what it made him do is not show the shark that much.
Yes.
That's where you get the shark point of view. You get the scenes where you see the sharks. And to me, that's the scarier stuff. That stuff of nightmares
yeah.
when I was a child. Just seeing the eye and the side of the face as it slides
just
out of the
fin.
Water.
Yeah.
Just the fin. Right. Those are iconic images. The one image I don't think you hear people talk about it a lot, but is really sort of indicative of, I think, Spielberg's approach to the supernatural, to the fantastical, is when Quint and Hooper and Brody are on the boat and they have put the barrel out there.
Yeah.
And the shark grabs whatever's beneath and he starts dragging them. Mm-hmm. And the boat is pulling and they, for days, are just watching the barrel bobbing along the surface of the water. And it creates a lot of tension. And you feel like you're looking at the shark. And what you're really just seeing is the tip of the iceberg. And I think that's an interesting thing for whether you're talking about supernatural or spiritual, the idea that you have this one mundane element that you're looking at, but it's all you can see, the tip of the iceberg,
yeah.
the little hint of the divine or hint of the unknown. And yet that to me is more effective and more kind of creates more tension, creates more wonder than when we finally see the shark pop out of the water and eat Quint. So.
Yeah.
Well, it's so built up also by the time the shark does come up out of the water, you've been trying to catch these glimpses of it the whole movie and all of a sudden, boom, there it is. And when I was a kid watching it, that had like the major shock effect at that point.
Yeah. So we run now to Close Encounters, which this is the setup for E.T. Because I think E.T. is a much stronger movie. I enjoyed E.T. a lot more. Close Encounters, I thought it was good, but not as good. Thoughts on that?
So Close Encounters of the Third Kind. One thing I just want to mention real quick, a little tidbit. In between, so Jaws obviously becomes a huge hit.
Yeah.
In between, Spielberg is offered Jaws 2, which he turns down. And I think he's sad that he even made a Jaws 2.
Yeah.
He's offered King Kong. King Kong gets made by, I think, Dino De Laurentiis, like in 1975 with Jeff Bridges and Jessica Lange. It really wasn't very good. And he also gets offered Superman. So you can even think about that. What would have a Jaws 2 helmed by Spielberg or a King Kong or a Superman? I think of the three, I would have liked to see him take a stab at Superman.
Yeah.
But we don't get those movies. Instead, we get Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which I think is by far a stronger movie than any of the three we just mentioned. I get what you're saying. It's hard for me. I think E.T. has a much more nostalgic place in my heart. So when we get to that, like I was a kid when I saw E.T. E.T. is very much aimed at children. I think E.T. is a more successful movie in a lot of ways, even though people would say it isn't. Like a lot of critics would point to Close Encounters and think that it's a little more adult or it's a little more serious and trying to get at serious ideas. I really like it. I think it's a problematic movie, but I think in some of its problems, it's actually what make it kind of fascinating. It's a fascinating movie because when it's over, I'm not still to this day, not entirely sure how I feel about it.
Right.
And it has that same kind of thing of Jaws where you've got the working class guy, and this it's Dreyfus again, as Rory Neary, playing a very different character than he was. I think the Hooper was more the smart aleck kind of character in Jaws, and here Roy is more, you know, he's kind of your average guy again.
Right.
He's just kind of
playing with his mashed potatoes.
Well, yeah, this means something. And he's the, I think, he's like a lineman or something, isn't he? Doesn't he work on...
I just remember his utility truck.
Right.
And at some point he actually loses his job in the very beginning. But you see him, he's a little bit like a tinker man because his house is got all the stuff in it and he's got the little train set and his wife's yelling at him about all the gears and stuff on the table. So, you know, even outside of his job, he's kind of a little bit of an oddball, I guess, little tinker man. That's what I thought, at least.
No, that and that's a good point. I never really thought about it because, Rachel, you just recently rewatched Close Encounters.
Yeah.
It's probably been 2 or 3 years since I've rewatched because I didn't rewatch it for this. Well, I guess we back up just a little bit, not the whole plot, but this movie involves aliens. It's the first time that Spielberg really taps into aliens. But to be fair, to say it involves aliens is probably not exactly accurate because where E.T. dealt with an alien from the very beginning, Close Encounters is more about the buildup. It's more about the potential of alien abductions. We see a child taken in the very early parts of the movie, and we see spaceships, and we do know they're spaceships because about I guess a third of the way through the film, they show up in a big special effects show where they all fly down. And you're sort of like, particularly 1977, same year as Star Wars, you're thinking, well, how is Spielberg going to top that? You know, with the ships, they kind of come out of the sky. And they're done very much like the accounts of like the Will-O-The-Wisps that people were reporting at the time. They come out of the sky. But then as they get closer, we see that they are ships. They have shapes and technology going on in them. And they're actually pretty cool. Like, I think compared to the starships we see in movies today, they have some personality. They kind of zip around and they interact, and the way they come into the frame, you just don't really see that. You know, you see them descend from the sky and come down and then go back
up. And they're causing things like metallic things to react magnetically, like in the truck and the mailbox is going off, or the kids' toys that are just operating by themselves, running down the hallway into the mom's room. And
that's another good example of how we talked about having the elements of the supernatural be defined by mundane things that you can observe. Like the regular world has ripples in it first, not unlike the glass of water in Jurassic Park. In fact, that's a good point. The water in Jurassic Park rippling is a sign of the wondrous thing. The bobbing barrel in Jaws, and in here the radio going on the Fritz, you know, or the metallic objects or the kids' toys. And you'll see that all the way through the movies. In Close Encounters, as the movie continues, it develops a very strange thing because when you mentioned that he's a tinkerer, basically Roy, after his experience where the ships kind of fly over his truck, he becomes obsessed.
Yeah.
But it's not just that he's becoming obsessed. He seems to be given images and urges to seek out this place that he doesn't know.
Yeah.
And he's building that mountain with his mashed potatoes in the middle of dinner.
And at the end, you kind of see that a lot of the people who are called to this location are artists. They kind of start putting that together. The one guy, I think he was a photographer. I might be wrong on that. And the one woman whose child's abducted, she's a painter. And she's like, I painted it, you know, from this side. I never painted it from the other side, you know, when she gets there. And he's like, that's why you should try sculpting it. You realize he's a sculptor. So,
which is an interesting point. So the artists and the people who are maybe a little bit more perceptive or sensitive, if you will, to more of the abstract are being called. And then when they are all called to a place where the spaceships show up, and the spaceships don't burn them up into fiery death or anything like that.
It does give them like a sunburn.
But of course the government again is the bad guy, really. You know, as they get closer, they see that all the dead cattle and things like that are not actually results of aliens, but results of the government trying to create a perimeter around the Devil's Hill where they're trying to get. And when they get there, they have this really neat, unique view of what communication between aliens and human beings would look like. Nathan, do you remember that scene? Talk about it at all?
It's the trying to think. It's the music scene, right?
Right. The mothership has come down, and they're communicating through music.
Yeah, I mean, and we played the disco version at the beginning of the show, so. Wasn't there something that it wasn't just music though? Wasn't there some kind of mathematical formula going on in there?
There's like a light board. It made me think of Simon. Remember the game Simon?
Yeah.
There's like a light board, and there's like colors flashing. And what they're doing, they're counting like the rhythms, or you know what note? I can't remember exactly, but they're putting together a pattern by the sound with the, and they're matching it like with. Obviously displaying it with the color, and then how many seconds per note or what tone. Somehow they're working out some equation with that.
Yeah. Which, you know, they tried to do in ID4 and they got blown up. So
that was totally like, well, we'll give you one moment of peace, and then we're going to start breaking up landmarks.
Yeah.
In Close Encounter, well, also part of the music is When You Wish Upon a Star, which goes back to Spielberg talk about his love of like Disney movies and, you know, the song from Pinocchio. Mm-hmm. And Pinocchio comes back in later when Spielberg does AI. We'll get to that down the road. I'd actually argue that AI is probably this movie that most resembles this one in some ways. I think, again, we kind of have a challenging sort of story. But the element I want to talk about just a little bit more before we move on is kind of what happens to Roy. Like, we've talked about the artists are being called and they go to the mountain. And in a normal movie, you would see a couple things happen, and then the movie would be primarily the chase of the government chasing them as they get to the mountain. That is in the movie, but there's a lot of movie dedicated to Roy seemingly, at least to everyone else, losing his mind.
Oh, yeah.
And the movie spends an enormous amount of time there, and I think it's more effective for that. But this is where you create a little bit of a disconnect, because the aliens, when they finally do show up, they are, at least they seem to be, benign. They are trying to communicate with us.
Battery's not included vibe to them.
Yeah, right. We'll get to that too. But the aliens are trying to legitimately communicate, it seems like. They're trying to move us out into space. And again, people take aliens very seriously. This is almost, aliens were almost a pseudo-religion at this time. Yeah. I mean, to be perfectly honest, people were, there were lots of books out there, Chariots of the Gods and things like this, where people were talking about the ancient astronaut theory that aliens had come down and given us the technology that we built the pyramids with and so on and so forth. So people were really into this stuff. And I think Spielberg, notwithstanding, were also kind of trying to capture, again, we talk about something being transcendent or this idea of the divine or something bigger than ourselves. In Close Encounters, it's not encapsulated with the idea of God, which maybe is different when we get to Raiders of the Lost Ark, but it's encapsulated here by the idea of the aliens. They are the divine force that comes down and, again, disrupts things in a different way.
Yeah.
Because once Roy is made aware that there's something else going on, that he's being called out, he can't ever be normal again.
Yeah.
And so you can see that and say, oh, that's kind of cool. That's neat. You're an artist. You're unique. But Spielberg doesn't shy away from showing that it pretty much destroys his family.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And when we see things and when we hear things, and even when we think of in a lot of spiritual terms or even in religion, you see where people, you know, you're called out of the world. You're going to be called away from this. You need to leave everything and go. We think and like, oh, yeah, but not everything, right? Roy doesn't have much left in terms of terrestrial possessions by the end of this movie. His family leave him, and he does not go back to his family.
Yeah.
That's a hard thing for me to...
It's not a simple thing either. Like, you see the effects it's having a family, then son sitting at the table crying, looking at his dad, and like, those aren't pretty images.
No, they're very realistic images. And then when he starts, it's funny when he makes the mashed potatoes, but even then, the whole family is watching him come unhinged in the middle of dinner.
That's when the boy's like crying.
And it's very different later when he breaks above the bushes and the shrubs and digs up dirt and builds the mountain inside of his house.
Destroys his house.
And that's when the family leaves and he doesn't get reconnected with them. The end of Close Encounters, Spielberg's happy ending for Close Encounters is that while the little boy and many of the pilots and stuff that disappeared over the years come back, Roy gets in the spaceship and leaves with the aliens. The last happy shot of the movie is the spaceship and Roy leaving and descending and leaving the earthly things behind. But it is one of those earthly things is his family.
Yeah.
And I think this is a good point to point out. Just a few years ago when Lincoln came out, 60 Minutes did an interview actually with Spielberg's parents. And it was interesting hearing them talk and Spielberg himself talk about the fact that when he was growing up, his parents did divorce, and when they after they moved out to Arizona, and when this was happening, he's talked about E.T. was sort of his movie that he tried to reconcile his parents' divorce in his mind by doing E.T. But in Close Encounters, and in several movies, particularly this early phase, fathers particularly are not shown in a very positive light. We go back to Something Evil. The mother is the maternal force. Darren McGavin's off at work. And and Spielberg talked about he kind of put his mother up on a pedestal. To him, his mother was almost more like a sister. So he saw her as his kind of his idol. It wasn't that he disliked his father, but he saw his father as a workaholic. And when they separated, he seemed to really – he mentions that he kind of blamed his father. Mm. It turned out later that really his mother was the one who initiated the separation because she fell in love with another guy. And Spielberg, once he even found that out, said, even though I knew it, I still blamed my dad for a long time. Even though I knew the truth, it was something – he goes, I don't know why, but I couldn't get beyond right. that. So you see this, it has an effect on his entire career, really, when you look at how fathers are portrayed, all the way down to Hook, where he starts to try and reconcile it. Yeah. But in Close Encounters, he's telling this fantastical story where we should be like, yes, this guy is going to leave behind his earthly things, but we do see the effect it has. I think that's mm-hmm. what makes the movie strong, because I don't know how to feel about it. This isn't a happy ending at all.
Yeah,
that's a little bit how I felt. I was like, what about your family? Yeah. Like when I got to the end of it.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Hook, but even think to AI.
Yeah.
Haley Joel Osment's adoptive family, you know, the father's really, you know, the douchebag in the film, and the mother mm-hmm. is the one who's, you know, really taken Haley Joel Osment as her son.
That's a good point. And that's one of the many things I think is like where there's a tie and a connection there. We see people searching for something. But I think Close Encounters is a great movie. Mm-hmm. It is maybe overshadowed. It isn't maybe as commercial or easily palatable or digestible. But it changed, again, the way we looked at some blockbuster filmmaking. Mm-hmm. It's a nice counterpoint to Star Wars the same year. I think they're both great movies. I think Close Encounters is a movie people don't go back to as much. But it's worth, I think, going mm-hmm. back and checking out, because it's a cornerstone of what he does.
Right. Well, and I think to your point, this is more for a movie for adults than children. I mean, the themes that are going on in here and the stuff that's happening, it's focusing on adult issues. So when I say it for adults, I don't mean, you know, kids can't watch it. You know, I think we were
But
all
it is scarier,
children.
You know, really. Oh, sure. It's almost done more like a horror film.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
I let a friend of ours borrow it one time, and they returned it to me. And I was like, oh, what'd you think? Yeah, no, we didn't watch it. Why? Well, we don't like being scared. And I'm just thinking, oh, benign, happy aliens and the spaceship music. They didn't make it past the point where the little boy was abducted. After that, they were like, horror movie. Boom, turned it off.
That's an intense scene. That throws back to Poltergeist or maybe Forward.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Poltergeist and stuff like that. When I watched it the other day, I was like, man, that's still a creepy. Of course, I'm thinking like the old house movies and stuff like that. Creepy scene. The oven's going up and the mom's so distracted, the boy just crawls out of her arms.
One thing I want to talk about quickly before we move on, I probably could have gone back and spoke about it with Jaws. We didn't see this much in his TV work or in Sugarland Express, but when you get to Close Encounters, it's very much there. And it's so iconic, one of Spielberg's techniques, that when J.J. Abrams starts making Spielberg-like movies, he adds these things artificially, like the lens flares, mm-hmm. like the flashlight beams in the dark, or when the lights descend kind of from the sky. Mm-hmm. Spielberg even has like a name for this. He kind of calls it the God light. Anytime when there's this light that is sort of illuminating or shining, and a lot of times it's in those wonder shots where the character is looking up, the light is basking their face. We know they're seeing something astounding. We know we're seeing something transformative. We don't know maybe yet what it is. Or the flashlight beam that illuminates through the dark, that literally pierces the dark and comes out and connects the audience with the only light that's happening on the screen sometimes. And he chalks this back up to, he mentions that when he was a very young kid, I think in an interview he said something like, when I was 6 months old, I'm like, I don't know if you remember when you were 6 months old.
Right.
I mean, he's not Paul Bunyan saying he ate like 56-foot flapjacks. But, you know, I mean, he mentions that he remembers being pushed through a synagogue in Cincinnati through the church and seeing the light shining down through the windows. And then when he started going to the movies, that same idea of the projector light from the back of the theater shining down on him in his mind connected the concept of the church and the movie theater as this place of illumination or transcendence. So I thought that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And you see that theme prominent throughout all his movies, even to today.
Yeah, and now it's in everyone else's movies, too.
Yeah.
But it's funny, in Jaws, there's only one scene of that, and that's when they're on the boat at night.
Yes.
And it's the first time, again, the shark is a mysterious entity, and the light shining out from, I guess, the boat light that they have where they're trying to search for the shark, where they're going and they're looking for the truth that they can prove to everyone else because everyone else doesn't believe them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now we run into very different movie. I mean, it's funny because there are threads that run throughout Spielberg's movies. And again, we talked about that idea that, you know, when you're going to see a movie of his, it's like, oh yeah, this is very definitively Spielberg. So we see that in Raiders of the Lost Ark, but now we're seeing a new type of action adventure film coming out. And so let's talk about that one a little bit. Nathan,
we talking about Howard the Duck? Oh, no. Spielberg had nothing to do with Howard the Duck.
Thankfully. Maybe he should have. I mean, maybe that could have saved the movie.
Maybe, but you know, what this is Spielberg's first collaboration with George Lucas. Yes. They're both at the height of their powers when they make Raiders of the Lost Ark. Yes. But I will say that, you know, if we see how it bears out, collaborations with Lucas don't really always work out in Spielberg's favor. So this first one is interesting because they had been talking that they wanted to do something.
Yes.
They both had the success of basking in the success of Jaws, Star Wars, and Close Encounters. I think both movies, and I could be wrong, maybe only one was, I thought both movies were nominated for Best Picture in 77. I know Annie Hall won that year, but I thought both of them were up. I like both movies very much, and of course, modern pop culture does too. Well, they were talking, and they wanted to, what they really wanted to do was a James Bond-style movie. And Spielberg was saying, you know, we need to work on something that could be like James Bond-esque. And one of the inspirations, actually, which is interesting because Spielberg does come back to this, is our comic books like the French comic book Tintin, with the young boy detective who goes on all these globe-trotting adventures, discovering artifacts and fighting off the thieves that want to steal the artifacts and things like that. And so Spielberg and Lucas come together and they're remembering their old days of watching like the old like Republic serials being not that crap in the box covered in sugar, but little short segments of films that would play in front of the main feature at a theater and would be things like Rocket Men from the Moon and things like that, little Flash Gordon adventure stories told in segments that you'd see a segment this week when you went to the theater, and next time you went to the theater you get the next segment, so you follow along. I mean, it's a serial in the same way we see things on television now.
Yes.
So those things were the inspirations for Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. And it's where they get the idea. And actually, I think there's a movie, either like Gold of the Aztecs or Treasure of the Aztecs, with Charlton Heston. He played a character named Harry Steele. And a lot of people track back and say Harry Steele is sort of the inspiration for Indiana Jones. And of course, Harrison Ford had just come off of two Lucas movies with American Graffiti and then Star Wars. He'd just been Han Solo. And so he gets hired. And I think he'd originally been doing carpentry on the Star Wars set, which is how he got hired. It's famous that like people like Christopher Walken and Al Pacino, a lot of different people, you know, had come in and tried out for the part but didn't get it. So now he's Indiana Jones. Raiders of the Lost Ark comes out. And it's interesting because I think when they make the movie, just like when Lucas made Star Wars, he's not thinking of it just in sense of a throwback, but they're trying to make movies that are love letters to what they saw growing up as kids, to their own nostalgia.
Yeah.
Here's what I think is cool about that. Nowadays, we see people make movies that they say are love letters to nostalgia, even a J.J. Abrams movie, Super 8, and all they do is retread what their favorite filmmakers had done. Lucas and Spielberg take Raiders and make it their own thing.
Yeah.
When we as kids saw Raiders, we didn't have the context, many of us didn't, of Flash Gordon or these serials that they spawned from. So Raiders feels original and new, even though to them it wasn't at all. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think too, what they're doing with it is, you know, they're bringing an element of the fantastical to it, and but they're doing it in such a way that brings it into our real world. I mean, at that time, in history, you know, there is an idea that people are churchgoers, so there is going to be some context to, you know, looking at the Ark of the Covenant, and you know, what if it could be discovered in this race with Hitler in Germany? So you have these ties that are coming in because, you know, you still have, I mean, while World War II is several generations away, it's still close enough that people are alive who fought in the war, and they've taught their children, and it's prevalent. And so let's take it, set it in Nazi Germany, where, you know, this could be a plausible thing. And so you then begin taking the fantastical and saying, well, what if this was real? Yeah. So it's not so far out there that, you know, it's clearly fantasy. There is an element of reality that's brought into the mix.
Yeah, Rachel, what do you think about Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark specifically?
A lot of what I – that's not one that I've revisited. A lot of what I remember about it is from watching it as a kid. So, my memories surrounding it are significantly different. I do remember, like, the Nazis and that there was a real enemy, not, like, Lex Luthor or something like that you would think of. you know, I remember as a kid that being a big hero, I think, among me and like, and us, I think really, I remember wanting to be able to take a whip and like wrap it around a tree limb and like swing from it or something, you know,
perfectly having all safe. Of that.
And it, well, it was funny. I think a couple years ago at Halloween, I was handing out candy, like 50 different Iron Men. And all of a sudden this little boy walked up, I kid you not, leather jacket, hat, and a whip. And I was like, all right. Gave him like extra candy. And his
You're
dad
Alec
was like,
Quartermain.
Yeah. And his dad was like, these were our heroes. And I was like, actually, yeah, like it wasn't this big mechanical thing. It was just this guy in a leather jacket with a whip and a hat, and that was so cool. Like, you know, and there was something about just the, like, technique being his talent, not really a superpower, you know? That element of it being real, but fantastical at the same time, I guess.
It's a great point. Indiana Jones is beat up a lot, particularly Raiders of the Lost Ark. In fact, it's interesting because we're probably jumping ahead. We should mention, I mean, there are obviously fantastic action scenes in this movie. And of course, one of the best scenes is the kind of improvised bit where the sword slinger comes up with his swords and starts, you know, doing all this stuff in front of him to intimidate him. He just shoots him. He thinks about fighting him with a weapon. He's like, nah, forget it. Shoots him and walks off. And of course, I mean, the Lucas probably would have redone that where, you know, the sword guy would have thrown a sword first.
Right.
But, in the context, I think what made a nice marriage between Lucas and Spielberg in that movie is you can see Lucas bringing a lot of the pulp elements that he wants to. I feel like Lucas always wanted to deliver unrestrained pulp stories to the screen. And I think for the benefit of all of us, thankfully he wasn't able to because he was limited in his early days. Star Wars, I truly believe that the prequels probably represent more what George Lucas wanted to have the Star Wars movies be than what the original trilogy ended up being. Partly because of not interference, but the collaborative aspects of the original series. Not just that, but also the limitations that he had to work with. I think that those limitations were helpful. And I think with Spielberg, the two of them were able to work together and create something that they were able to play up each other's strengths.
Yes.
And make a movie that was very spirited and a lot of fun, but had some serious like corners and edges to it.
Yeah.
And we talk about like that bit with the Ark of the Covenant. Indiana Jones doesn't save the day in Raiders of the Lost Ark. In fact, you think about it, this is an interesting thing. Saving the day is something that is a much more modern concept for the blockbuster.
Yes.
I think something I thought about as I was watching Spielberg movies. You know, yes, we're trying to kill the shark in Jaws. In Close Encounters, he's trying to discover the alien spaceship. You know, we need to get E.T. home. Raiders of the Lost Ark, Indiana Jones says, and it's weird to think where this comes from, but this deserves to be in a museum, you know?
Right.
He wants to preserve the Ark. He's not, yes, we want to stop the Nazis, but that's almost secondary, you know what I mean? The fate of the world didn't need to be at stake in every single summer movie in order for that movie to have real stakes to the audience. I think we've lost sight of that, you know?
Yeah.
The world is never really in danger of blowing up, but he doesn't play a role in the final scene. He's tied to a stake with Marion, Karen Allen's character, and while he does that, God comes down and wipes everybody out because the Ark is opened up, you know, and we see the beam come out. An interesting side story. It's funny how much of Spielberg has been built into our pop culture identity, if you will, that sometimes the lines between things start to blur. Years ago at my job, I was sitting there and I was listening to a person in her cubicle talk about she was talking about spiritual things with her friend and talking about her. First off, there was something wrong when she said, my favorite part of the Bible is the wrath of God. And I thought, well, right off the bat, we got a few issues. And then she talks about that her favorite element of scripture is the part in the Bible where they open the Ark of the Covenant and it burns up all the enemies of the Lord. And I had to stand up and say, well, that's not scripture, that's Spielberg. So it's interesting how much, you know, if you're not paying close attention, the lines should not blur.
Right.
But what's interesting, I think, about that ending is, again, we have the divine who comes out in a very big way. These days, like that Deus Ex Machina, where it comes down and just like wipes out everybody, is not something that would really be very satisfying. But it is. It's satisfying watching the Nazis burn to a crisp.
Right.
Not just the Nazis, but the idea of somebody who is trying to... There's an element where they are basically desecrating this holy object and relic, but they're also desecrating, these are the Nazis desecrating a Jewish heritage and tradition.
Yeah.
And then we go back. Spielberg's spoken many times that growing up in Arizona, he felt, you know, he felt like an outsider. He was physically picked on and beat up sometimes for being Jewish.
Yeah.
He mentions that particularly early on and even through some of his career, he was actually a little bit he wasn't proud of his Jewish heritage. He said, and he's kind of appalled by it now, but he said when he was growing up, he actually used to tell kids that his name was German in origin, not Jewish. And so that you see something in Raiders of the Lost Ark, it's down a little bit, but Roger Ebert picked up on it and mentioned it, that there's almost a sense of like vindication fantasy mm-hmm. in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
The Jewish God comes down and puts nobody in question of his ability and of his might and
right.
of... And he stops the Nazis in their tracks.
Yeah.
And I think it's that thing. There's a little bit of playing that out. That kid who's picked on as a, you know, growing up and who his grandfather tells him war stories of fighting the war, the only war that we can say, the right war, the just war against the Nazis. And now Spielberg in a fantasy film gets to not just express the transcendence, but this one, the transcendence comes back and there's a price to be paid.
Yeah.
Well, not to flash too far forward, doesn't he do Schindler's List?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and,
yes.
And mm-hmm. he was saying like that movie almost ended his career because it affected him so deeply. He didn't know if he could keep moving on. He went like on a 4-year hiatus after making that. So there's surrounding the Holocaust and the Nazis. There's obviously going to be like emotional
yeah.
energy there.
And I think Schindler's List is a movie he credits as being that movie where he reconciled and really started to bring his Jewish faith to the forefront mm-hmm. in his life and in movies. Mm-hmm. And he founded the Shoah Foundation with the survivors of the Holocaust. So he was very much involved in that. You're right. He didn't make another movie till 97's Lost World at that mm-hmm. point. But
yeah.
Nathan, what about your relationship with Indiana Jones?
Yeah. I mean, I remember again, like to me, it's hard separating, you know, Lucas and Spielberg from this one. So I always think of both of them in this and, you know, you're right. Lucas, Unfettered, we get, you know, Star Wars, The Next Generation, which, you know, is sadly disappointing. But Spielberg has a way of just taking that and reining it in and pulling everything together. And so to me, like this movie, you know, not knowing anything about Temple of Doom coming out and, you know, The Last Crusade, and then, you know, the failure that was The Crystal Skull, which we will talk about. You know, this movie just really pulled everything together. It was a great total story. Like I said, it brought in the elements of the fantastical, that adventure, that sense of awe and wonder, but yet brought it in a very real way. To me, it was almost like what the X-Men movies did with the comic books. You know, it was like, you know, this is a comic book movie. You know, this is fantastical, but it's bringing it into the real world with people you can, you know, you can actually picture these people walking around in real life, interacting with one another. And so to me, Indiana Jones, like I could picture a guy out there, you know, making these discoveries, going on these adventures and really, you know, put myself in his position. It wasn't just another cartoon. It wasn't so spectacular that I couldn't envision this. And so, you know, yeah, you know, dressing up in the leather jacket with the whip and the hat and going around and, you know, having my little rope, trying to wrap it around a tree branch and swing across and many a tree branch breaking and, you know, but it was all part of, you know, just bringing that adventure into reality. And
I wonder how many front teeth were casualties because of Spielberg. That's an awesome point, though, about like the reality, because I don't think of Raiders of the Lost Ark as a realistic movie at all in some senses, but it was taking that high energy pulp that like a kid reading it in the 40s or 50s, and it's so overheated and so overblown, and making it plausible that you yeah. get into it, that you believe the action scenes, that you believe what's happening
yeah.
with it, which is essentially a very kind of out there, over the top, yeah. not realistic story.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's part of it. You talked about believing the action scenes. You know, you have the scene where the reality is if a guy's got a sword and I've got a gun, I'm just going to shoot him. You know, yeah. forget a fair fight. You know, mm-hmm. you never should have brought a sword to a gunfight type deal. You know, the scene where he's fighting outside of the airplane, you know, and there's that big guy, you know, it's not, again, you talked about Indiana Jones not really being the quote unquote hero of the story. It's not Indiana Jones that takes out the big guy. It's the prop on the plane, you know?
That's very true. Well, and yeah, go ahead, Brad.
I was just going to say, like, I like, as at least as a kid, I liked the fact that he was a hero of sorts, but then also like an ordinary guy. I mean, it's some, there was also that like element of unrealistic, because you're like, is the nerdy professor, does he really have the ability to go out and be this like jungle man or whatever, you know, traversing these temples and stuff? Mm-hmm. But he's just an ordinary guy, and he makes kind of comical mistakes along the way. Mm-hmm.
And how many like archaeology and anthropology professors at the time were like, yeah, man, this is it. Like, right. you see me now, but you know what I'm doing on the weekend.
That's right.
but you're right. I always enjoy those scenes where you see him stuffy and like the girl's got the like love you written on her, or like on her eyes when she blinks at him in the classroom, and he's kind of nerdy and uptight. And then a few minutes later, he's, you know, out in the middle of the African wilderness somewhere doing something. But, yeah, that's what makes the movie really neat. But in those realistic scenes, like that scene where after Marion disappears, but he believes her to be dead, she's been abducted, but he doesn't know this. He's watched the car blow up. He thinks she's dead. And he's there, and he meets up with the villain who comes in and is talking to him. And he basically is getting ready to shoot both of them. He's like, well, let's go, you know? He's ready to basically, you know, suicide himself to take this guy out. And at that point, you were saying John Rhys Davies, like, Sala has all his kids run in.
Yeah.
He's like, I got enough. He just sends his kids in to, like, rescue Indiana Jones before he does something, you know, tragically stupid.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's really, you know, what captures people of all ages, because I remember watching it as a child, but I remember watching it with my father, you know, and someone of his age and his generation watching it and loving the adventure of it and being able to go along with the story as well, I think is a testimony to, you know, is it a movie that, you know, a young child probably should have been watching? Maybe not. There, you know, definitely some graphic elements, especially at the end.
That arc scene is, yes. That was one of the few things I remember seeing in a movie that really scared me badly as a kid.
Yeah. Yeah. But as a child, you can almost work past it because it's a brief scene and you have all this action and adventure.
You can work past it unless you're a Baptist and hear more about that kind of stuff every Sunday morning.
Yeah, that's true.
We're going to go ahead. We're going to end the first segment of Spielberg, and we'll catch you all next week for our second segment.
Yeah, take care. Have a good night.
Really shook the pillars of heaven, didn't we, Wayne?